It is Friday, October 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, the United States and Russia discuss their differences on Syria. China announces further slowing economic growth.
We're seeing continued slowdown in Chinese industrial production and investment. They're the key areas of weakness. The flip side, though, is that we are seeing strength in consumer spending in China.
And a new film explores the life of country music legend Hank Williams. It's all ahead. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov have begun talks in Vienna. They're trying to find common ground on Syria's political future. I'm joined on the line by VOA State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins. Well, Pam, this meeting is multilateral. It also includes representatives from Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and also from the United Nations. How could this impact these talks?
Well, absolutely, yes, because there is broad interest in Syria's instability. And while Turkey and Saudi Arabia generally align with the U.S. in terms of the overall position, they also have their own regional concerns, especially considering Syria's instability and its close proximity to those countries.
On Thursday, the United States Ambassador to the UN, Samantha Power, said Russian airstrikes were an interference in Syria, and she was saying that these airstrikes are making the Islamic State stronger. Now, of course, the Russians said the reason they were conducting this mission in Syria was to actually go after IS.
Absolutely. There's a great deal of disparity between the two positions. As a matter of fact, the United Nations has said that the Russian offensive in Syria has forced as many as 50,000 people from their homes in Aleppo and about 35,000 from their homes in Hama. So they see the situation as quite destabilizing. And then also there's a difference in the overall focus. While the U.S. strikes have targeted Islamic State positions, the Russian strikes are broader. The U.S. says that the majority of them have been on opposition positions. And, of course, the U.S. has been lending support to the moderate Syrian opposition in its fight against Bashar al-Assad.
Now, this meeting comes shortly after the very quick visit of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to Moscow, where he met with Russian President Vladimir Putin. How could that visit to Moscow impact these talks?
Yes, the timing of the visit was very interesting, and I'm sure that it's something that is on the minds of the U.S. officials as well as Turkey and Saudi Arabia. Russia, of course, has backed President Assad politically and militarily, while the U.S. believes that Assad should not be part of any long-term political resolution to Syria's conflict. On Thursday, President Putin accused the United States of playing a double game in Syria that involved fighting terrorists while trying to use some of them to advance their own interests in the region.
All right. Thanks very much, Pam. That is VOA State Department Pam Dawkins reporting from Vienna. For reaction on social media about this, I'm joined by International Edition's Olin Akisholu. Olin, what's being said about the meeting in Vienna?
Hi, Sarah. Well, social media is pretty quiet about the meeting right now. Kerry didn't tweet about the meeting from his personal account yet. The Russian Foreign Ministry tweeted out a few photos of Kerry and Lavrov shaking hands and sitting down to talk. But news of the meeting is still pretty fresh, so we might see more of a response on social media depending what comes about in the meeting.
Well, what else is trending?
So a big trend right now is hashtag Patricia. That's a reference to Hurricane Patricia, which is expected to make landfall on western Mexico later today. Earlier this morning, wind speeds rose to 200 miles per hour, and that makes it the strongest tropical cyclone ever measured in the western hemisphere. People are just amazed at how powerful the storm is. The most common tweet I found was simply wow or whoa. I read one comment suggesting maybe this means we need to add a Category 6 to the Saffir-Simpson scale, which is what we use to measure hurricanes. Alex Lammers, who's a meteorologist at National Weather Service, and I hope I said his name right, in Tallahassee, he had a very powerful tweet this morning. He tweeted, The plane just measured a 192-knot peak flight-level wind, 192 knots. That's 221 miles per hour. I'm just sitting here in stunned silence. Pictures of Hurricane Patricia and short GIFs of its path are getting shared a lot. And just looking at how massive this hurricane is, people on social media are just in awe. And another trend that's continuing since yesterday is talk about Hillary Clinton's marathon 11-hour testimony to Congress about Benghazi. There were a ton of hashtags that came out around the event. Just to name a few of them, hashtag Benghazi Committee, hashtag Free Hillary, hashtag Hillary for Prison 2016. It was really interesting to see how people kept up with it on social media yesterday. And I saw a funny tweet from NBC News just a couple of minutes ago. And that was a bunch of faces that Hillary made during the testimony. So that whole fire hasn't quite burned out yet.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Olin. That's Olin Akhisholu. In other news, China announced more bad economic news this week, with third quarter growth from July through September at the slowest pace in 6 years, coming in at 6.9%. It follows months of stock volatility, a slowdown in investment, and weak trade and manufacturing data as the world's second largest economy transitions to a more consumer-oriented economy. Chief economist Shane Oliver of the Sydney-based AMP Capital tells International Edition's Victor Beatty the Chinese economic picture today is a mixed one.
We're seeing continued slowdown in Chinese industrial production and investment. They're the key areas of weakness. The flip side, though, is that we are seeing strength in consumer spending in China. So the Chinese economy is gradually migrating from being heavily focused on industrial production and investment towards a greater strength in consumer spending. So we are seeing a rebalancing in that economy. But, of course, it has come at a price of a loss of momentum over the course of the last year. I guess the good news, though, is that if you look at the quarter itself, it does seem as if the quarterly growth rate does seem to be stabilising a little bit, but the annual growth rate is still down on where it has been over the last few years.
Shane, another AP article poses a question. What happens to the Chinese economy resounds far beyond Shenzhen and Shanghai. Those impacted range from South African coal miners and Canadian oil field workers to Australian gas producers and Americans saving for retirement.
The Chinese economy certainly does have a big impact globally. We didn't used to worry, say, 20 years back, but it's the world's now the world's second biggest economy after the US. And, of course, it's been growing at a quite strong pace. So, therefore, in terms of its contribution to economic growth globally, it does provide the biggest contribution. And therefore, any changes in its growth rate does have an impact right around the world, particularly on commodity producers, whether they be in Latin America or Australia. And, of course, it also has an impact on consumers in places like the US and Europe. So huge impact from changes in the Chinese economy. I guess the reality, though, is that no economy can continue to grow at 10% plus indefinitely. Balances were starting to build up. And we have seen the economy in China adjust from that heady pace we saw last decade. So I think it's something the world has to get used to, that China is not going to be growing as strongly as it used to. The world needs to find other sources of growth, and hopefully over time they will emerge. Places like India and other countries in Asia, as well as hopefully South America, can start to get its act together as well. But in the short term, the moves in China do have a big impact globally, and that's why global investors are paying so much attention to it these days.
Shane, on Monday, the Obama administration said China's currency remains undervalued in relation to the dollar, but did not cite the country for unfairly manipulating its currency to gain trade advantages. Is this a change in U.S. approach toward China's currency?
At the margin, the U.S. approach is becoming a little bit more moderate. There was a view that the Chinese currency was dramatically undervalued, but over the last decade or so, the Chinese authorities have moved the value of their currency up against the U.S. dollar. And more recently, that's occurred at a time when the U.S. dollar has been rising against other currencies. So the Chinese currency has gone from being very undervalued. It may still be a bit undervalued against the US dollar, but nowhere near as much as it used to be. So that's, I think, why we're seeing that moderation at the margin on the part of the US authorities. The problem for America, though, is that it continues to run a huge trade deficit with China. So there is still a degree of discomfort in the US about China's currency. But if you're in other parts of the world, it's not as big of an issue anymore. So difficult balancing act there, I think, for the Chinese when they realized the need to make the currency more flexible earlier this year, and it actually fell. They tried to try and stabilize it again. So I think a difficult transition for the Chinese at the moment is they go from being a heavily fixed exchange rate, more regulated exchange rate, to being a more flexible one.
That's Shane Oliver of AMP Capital in Sydney, Australia. The Chinese currency has lost more than 2% of its value since its surprise devaluation of the yuan, or renminbi, between August 11th and the end of September. U.S. business and members of Congress have long accused Beijing of artificially holding down the currency's value to boost exports. In its previous semi-annual report to Congress in April, the U.S. Treasury Department said the Chinese currency was significantly undervalued. In its current assessment, the department said China should allow its currency to respond more freely to market forces. It said further appreciation is key to rebalancing China's economy. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Since 2004, NASA's Cassini spacecraft has been sending back spectacular images and providing scientists with valuable data about Saturn and its many moons. Cassini has returned to Saturn's ice-covered and sixth largest moon, Enceladus. The spacecraft has passed by the moon a number of times since 2005. During a recent flyby, the spacecraft sent back high-resolution images of the moon's northern region. The scientists were quite surprised to see what Cassini had sent back. Based on images taken by the 1970s Voyager mission, they thought that the moon's northern region would be heavily cratered. Instead, the new images show that Enceladus's northern landscape is crisscrossed by a spidery web of what looks like delicately thin cracks that cut across its surface. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we'll hear about a new film that explores the life of country music star Hank Williams. An international group investigating misuse of resource wealth says Myanmar's jade industry is worth more than $30 billion annually, totaling nearly half of the country's gross domestic product. Steve Herman reports from our Southeast Asia Bureau in Bangkok.
If accurate, the estimate, which is part of a report released Friday by the London-based group Global Witness, would put Myanmar's secretive jade industry at a value 10 times that of the illicit and more notorious opium poppy trade. Juman Kuba is an analyst for the British non-governmental organization.
It's the best estimate that's available so far. What we actually want, though, is to get more information in the public domain so that more reliable figures can come out. There is no doubt this is the most valuable industry in the country.
The report alleges that most of the jade trade is linked to ex-junta bosses, including former military ruler General Tan Shui, current figures in the powerful military, and drug lords. Kuba, speaking to VOA from Yangon, says little ends up in the government's coffers.
This is an industry which we're finding is dominated by the most corrupt and notorious figures in the country.
Proceeds from jade mining and trading collected by the military are also believed by people in Kachin to help finance the war against the rebels in the state. Colonel James Lum Dao of the Rebel Kachin Independence Organization concurs with much of what is contained in the report, but tells VOA it is impossible to accurately gauge how much money the government of Myanmar, also known as Burma, makes from the jade business.
You will not catch how much amount of money that the Burmese government is earning. That's all top secret.
The report says army officers in Kachin State are getting rich through extortion, but jade is also a main source of income for the KIO and its military arm, the Kachin Independence Army, which has been fighting the government since 1961. Colonel Lum Dao asserts the military and corrupt government officials rake in billions of dollars, but that is not the case for the Kachin rebels, and little of the riches trickles down to the people.
Out of this, maybe we can tax very little money from businessmen, not from the government.
Jade mining, which has turned swaths of Kachin State into moonscapes and perilous mountains of mining waste, is now being conducted on an industrial scale. Kuba of Global Witness says the United States should apply more pressure on Myanmar.
If it's important that the U.S. uses the influence it has, not least through the sanctions, to try and push for more data to come out and real change to happen, and for issues like jade and natural resources to be part of the peace negotiations.
Activists say extraction of jade in Kachin State has significantly increased in recent months, perhaps because of anxiety that the November 8th general election could change the political landscape. The opposition National League for Democracy, led by Aung San Suu Kyi, is forecast to make significant gains. However, the military will automatically control one quarter of the legislative seats. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondence, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondence, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is International Edition. Well, another country music icon story is coming to the big screen. I Saw the Light tells the story of country legend Hank Williams. Written and directed by Mark Abraham, the film chronicles Williams' meteoric rise to fame and its ultimately tragic effect on his health and personal life. The movie premiered in Nashville this past weekend. Nikki Strong of VOA Music is here to talk about it. Nikki, tell us about Hank Williams.
Wow, Hank is awesome. Now, even though he's categorized as a country music artist, he is considered one of the most influential singer-songwriters in American music history. I mean, Bob Dylan cites him as a major influence. I was introduced to a lot of Hank's music through Elvis Presley. He is one of country music's first superstars, one of the first to be inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame. He was born from humble beginnings. He had spina bifida, which separated him from his peers growing up, and he found solace in music. And he was strongly influenced by what was playing on the radio as well as church choirs, and he learned how to play guitar from an African-American street performer named Rufus Payne, which largely informed his musical style, and along with Roy Acuff and Ernest Tubb. He went on to work for a radio station, formed a band, pursued his career, continued to write multiple hits such as Hey Good Lookin', we know that one, I'm So Lonesome, I Could Cry, Your Cheatin' Heart, and went on to win various honors. The film is based on the book Hank Williams, The Biography by Colin Escott. The director and screenwriter, Mark Abraham, focuses on the period between 1944 to 1953. So that's when Hank was 21, married his first wife, Audrey, until his death at only 29 years old due to excessive alcohol and drug abuse.
How has the film been received so far?
Okay, well, this is not the first biopic on Hank Williams, yeah. So there's a lot out there. Reviews are mixed. There's a lot of focus on his personal life and marital problems, when some wanted more of a better understanding of what made Hank's music resonate so strongly during that time in history, and what it was about his work and his artistry that made him a superstar. However, one thing that has been getting great reviews consistently is Tom Hiddleston as Hank Williams. They say he may win an Oscar for his performance. That's how strong it is.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, the film won't be an Oscar contender this year, though, because its release was pushed back.
Yeah, it was supposed to be released in November, so it was supposed to be released next month. But they decided to push the movie back because it's a crowded award season, and Sony didn't want it to get lost in the shuffle. And the lead, Tom Hiddleston, the actor, was unavailable for promotional duties because he's busy shooting another movie and he just finished a television show. So,
when will it be released?
Okay, it's going to be out March 25th of next year.
Okay, thanks very much, Nikki. You can catch up with Nikki Strong on Country Hits USA on VOA 1. You can reach her on Twitter at @VOA_music or on Facebook at VOA Music. Thanks a lot, Nikki.
Thank you.
Your cheating heart will make you weep. You'll cry and cry and try to sleep, but sleep won't come the whole night through. Your cheating heart will tell on you.
That is the music of Hank Williams. Well, the U.S. hardwood flooring retailer Lumber Liquidators pleaded guilty in federal court Thursday to knowingly buying wood that was illegally harvested from an endangered Siberian tiger habitat in eastern Russia. The company will pay more than $23 million in fines. According to the Justice Department, Lumber Liquidators bought hardwood floors manufactured in China made from timber logged from the Mongolian oak forests in eastern Russia. The forests are home to the world's last 450 wild Siberian tigers and the 50 remaining Amur leopards. Well, that is our show. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us and have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In theory, every Russian citizen has the right to profess individually or jointly with others any religion or to profess no religion. He or she may also freely choose, possess, and disseminate religious or other beliefs and to act in conformity with them. These rights are guaranteed by the Russian Constitution, which also forbids discrimination or abridgment of the rights of citizens on religious grounds. Yet by law, officials may prohibit the activity of a religious association for violating public order or engaging in extremist activity. Russian law on religion defines Christianity, Islam, Judaism, and Buddhism as the country's four traditional religions, but also grants special status to the Russian Orthodox Church. According to the U.S. State Department's recently issued 2014 Religious Freedom Report, in accordance with the law, government-approved religious groups and other established Judeo-Christian religious groups were mostly left in peace by authorities. That was not the case with minority religious groups, which are required to register with the government, an onerous and expensive process. With the creative use of vaguely worded laws on extremism and incitement to violence, government entities harassed, fined, and prosecuted members of minority religions, even going so far as to confiscate their religious literature. Indeed, laws against extremism have been used to revoke the registration of minority religious groups, to refuse to register certain religious organizations, and to impose restrictions that infringe on the practice of minority religious groups. Such restrictions have hobbled their ability to purchase land and build places of worship. Although Judaism is specifically named as one of Russia's traditional religions, anti-Semitic rhetoric on the part of politicians and government officials, as well as increased anti-Semitic statements in government-controlled media, have risen steadily over the past year. Vandalism of synagogues, cemeteries, and mosques increased. The United States urges the Russian government to afford all citizens the right to worship as they see fit, as stated in the Russian Constitution. The right to religious freedom is not contingent on having a large number of followers, said Secretary of State John Kerry. Religious minorities, including those who profess no faith, should have the same rights as religious majorities, and that is a fundamental belief.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.